Today, a song for the Sabbath.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I should just point this out at the beginning because I don't want to spend time talking about it later when we're on a roll, so to speak. The Sabbath is Saturday. It's the Jewish Sabbath. And we use the language a lot of times of Sunday being the Christian Sabbath. And that's fine. I mean, it's appropriate language in some senses because that's the day we normally rest. At least a lot of people use Sunday as their day of rest in the Christian tradition. And so we speak of it as if it's the Christian version of the Jewish Sabbath happens on Sunday. But it's not exactly the same thing, and I don't want to spend today haggling out the theology of the distinctions and all that and the nature of the duty to rest and so on. We don't need to do all of that. The most important part of this psalm, which is about the Sabbath, translates perfectly to what we think of on Sundays for our gathering as Christians, that is, the time of worship that we spend together. Because it is a psalm, this is Psalm 92, because it is a psalm, a song for the Sabbath, that's the superscript to this psalm, it is written to be sung together if you're in the synagogue, it's in the synagogue. If you're in worship outside of the temple, then it's there. It's, you know, wherever. But you gather on the Sabbath with your family, whatever. You sing this song together, but you're singing it not only together on the Sabbath, but about the Sabbath. It's teaching us something about it. And because of, you know, it's, I think, just the tradition of it and the fact that we've done it for so long, we sometimes lose our sense of why we worship together. And I don't mean that we don't know there's some purpose to it. And I don't even mean necessarily the purpose to it in the way we think of it. Well, it's so we can hear the word of God. It's so we can lift up our voices in song. It's so we can whatever. I don't mean that as much as what it accomplishes by simply existing. The Sabbath day as this day when we observe and recognize God's reality and presence in the world and so on, and we do it corporately, we do it even if we're not gathered, but I do mean gathered as well, but even if we're not gathered, we're doing it corporately because we're all doing it at the same time. That itself conveys something momentous, something of far greater gravity than I think we often acknowledge. And so this psalm really hits that home, Psalm 92. So I'm wanting to share that with you today and just be upfront about it. So the opening line of the psalm, it invites us to keep that context in it, the Sabbath. And what the Sabbath does, if you just think about it for a minute, you'll recognize this because, you know, you have 6 days, God creating the world, and then the seventh day, it's the Sabbath, and he rests. And that language is brought back to the commandment itself when we're told to observe the Sabbath. I'll read it for you in just a moment. It inherently, by its nature, forces us to see both the transcendence of the Creator and his immanence in the creation at the same time, because you've set apart this day as holy, but it is the seventh day. It's not a non-day. It doesn't have some special name to it. Well, there are 6 days, and then there's black, black. You know, there's not a separate type of thing that exists after the sixth day. The seventh day, which is one of the 6 days, is completely different than the others. Why is it completely different than the others? So the Sabbath sort of forces us to bring transcendence and immanence together so that we see them in the same context. So in the first three verses, and I divide this a little differently than you'll see it divided in some of the Bibles, the ESV in particular, Not much of a difference, just a little difference. I put the first three verses together because they make a complete thought. And the starting in verse 4, it leads down to this consistent statement about the creation and how we relate to it that seems to be different. The first three verses really do run like an introduction to the rest of the psalm. So it's this is how the first three verses go. It is good to give thanks to the Lord. And again, you could begin a lot of psalms this way, but this one being about the Sabbath, we need to hear ourselves singing this together, saying it makes sense for us to be doing this, right? That we would all be together in the room looking at each other, singing the song and saying it is good that we do this. And then what that invites is our consideration of the answer to the question, why? Why is it good for us to do this? And that's what the rest of the psalm does. So starting in verse 1, it says it this way. It is good to give thanks to the Lord. Yahweh is the name there. It is good to give thanks to the Lord, to sing praises to your name, O Most High, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night, to the music of the lute and the harp, to the melody of the lyre. I mean, it's an introduction to worship, right? So it's good that we're singing this song with these instruments and doing it together. And we're doing it in observance of the Sabbath. And if you just think back to the institution of the ordinance, the law, that we would observe the Sabbath, that the people of God would observe the Sabbath in Exodus 20, when Moses receives the tablets and brings down the law to the people. What we're constantly reminded of in the giving of that particular command, starting in verse 8 of Exodus 20, is about its relationship with the creation, so that the whole span of the creation is to obey the Sabbath day. So when we hear the command, I'm going to read it to you in just a moment. As I'm reading it to you, you'll remember how he talks about not only you observing the Sabbath, but your manservant and your maidservant and so on. And we think of it as just a list. He's just being emphatic, make sure everybody does it. It's not, it is emphatic, and obviously it is important that everyone do it. But what he's saying is this covers the whole scope of creation. And if you think to a prophet like Jonah and the episode of repentance that takes place in Nineveh, where they even have the cattle wearing sackcloth and ashes. Remember the whole repentance of all of creation, and that being a theme in the book of Jonah, that it's the whales in the deep that are obedient, the gourds, the vegetation that are obedient to God's sovereignty, and that his grace extends as far as his sovereignty. It's a fantastic book when you recognize the creation being used in the book to talk about God's power and his grace at the same time. Well, the Sabbath is sort of doing that too. It's saying in this command, the whole creation is to take a break now because the Creator took a break on the seventh day. So in verse 8, this is in Exodus 20, not in Psalm 92, but in the original giving of the law, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who's within your gates. Yeah, they're not even Jewish. They come, they're like, I'm not Jewish, should I have to keep the Sabbath? Yeah, you do, actually. It's for the whole of creation. That's why everyone does it. Because, and how do I know it's about creation? Because if we weren't paying attention through that list, he actually says, he tells us about the creation again. So in Exodus 20, when the law is being given about the Sabbath, he says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. And the transcendence and immanence of this is obvious. It's, Yahweh, who is the Creator, we recognize that he deserves worship, not just service within his creation. I mean, he created it, and he gave us dominion over it, and he gave us responsibility in it. You would think, oh, well, I'm worshiping because my hands are doing my job. Yeah, you are in some ways, but that's not the worship of the transcendent God the way we're supposed to remember and recognize who he is on the Sabbath day when we put aside all of our attention and focus on the things that he created and instead focus uniquely on him. Transcendence about him sort of surfaces automatically, rises to the top on the Sabbath day, while at the same moment, the fact that it is a Sabbath day and that we gather and that it is after 6 days of work and that it is brief, it's only one day and then we go back to work, forces us to recognize that holiness within his creation as well. So the holiness of his creation is present in the Sabbath because we have put the other 6 days not just aside, but we've recognized that they are set apart and sanctified by the fact that on this day, we remember who created them. We remember who created all the other people who are in the world, but we worship the one who created them. But we remember them. So transcendence and immanence are sort of forced together. And I wouldn't just pick that out. I mean, there's so many things that happen on the Sabbath and so many things that make it a rich event, all of which would be worth talking about if we were just having a random show about all the different potential symbols that are present in the Sabbath and all the weights of sanctity that are present in the Sabbath. There would be more things to talk about than we could get through. Maybe we should do an episode on that sometime. But I'm not choosing this one randomly. I'm choosing it because I've read through this psalm, and I know the focus that he's putting on it. As we work through the images that are present in it, you're going to see when I pick up in verse 4, but you also start to see it in verse 1 because he is the Most High God in this moment. But you'll start to see the different metaphors that are being used, including the things about God that we recognize, how high he is above everything, in one sense, because of the creation and the nature of judgment that needs to come, but also simply his uprightness within the creation. And those two metaphors together also tie together transcendence and immanence. You understand the image that I'm talking about, saying God is high and lifted up above all of creation, that he's very high and that his thoughts span all the way into the deep, says that the creation entirely belongs to him, but he is above it all. He is untainted by the nature of the creation. He is high. So in fact, the shortest verse in the psalm, which I'll get to later in verse 8, the shortest verse in the psalm, and it's surrounded by the two longest verses in the psalm, says, "You, O Lord, are on high forever." That's the nature of the transcendence that we're talking about. The opposite phrase at the end of the psalm is the one that appeals not to how high he is, but to how upright he is. And that's within the creation. He's like a pillar within this creation. But it's not just him standing there. That's the beauty of it being a psalm about the Sabbath. So we'll have to work through the Sabbath to make sense of what I'm saying there. But it relates together the transcendence and immanence of the Sabbath in a pretty powerful way, and I think an encouraging way to believers. So let's take those sections. I think there are really just two sections from here. We finished verse 3, so we're picking up in verse 4. It'll go through verse 9. It's all pretty straightforward. It is a creation part of the psalm. It's all about the different elements of the creation and bringing them together for what they reveal to us, and it reveals what creation accounts always reveal: judgment. Because in the fallen creation, there's judgment, but also for a different reason that I'll explain in just a moment. So starting in verse 4, "For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the work of your hands, I sing for joy." You hear the creation. "How great are your works." And again, you can talk about the creation in 100 different ways. But when you talk about the Sabbath and then bring up the creation, it is to remind us of the 6 days of work that God did, bringing all of this together and then putting us in it, right? So how great are your works? He has said it over and over here. In verse 4, "O Lord, you've made me glad by your work. At the works of your hands, I sing for joy. How great," in verse 5, "are your works, O Lord. Your thoughts are very deep." This is the Most High God, the one who's lifted up above all in verse 1. And now his thoughts go all the way to the bottom of the ocean. "Your thoughts are very deep." So this is the transcendent God. And what we always discover when we confront the creation with its creator is the fact that it is temporal when he's eternal. And not just passively, but actively temporal, like pursuing death and destruction. And so we're going to bring up the wicked next. So in verse 6, and don't kill the messenger, I'm just reading the words that are in the ESV translation, which seem to be a really solid translation of what it says in Hebrew. So in verse 6, the stupid man cannot know. The fool cannot understand this. What is it they don't understand? Well, I mean, they probably don't understand anything of what we read already, but it's, you know, presumed that it's leading forward. What they don't understand starts in verse 7, that though the wicked sprout like grass, I mean, they grow super fast, they're like a weed, though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, we've talked about that in previous Psalms, all evildoers flourish. In previous Psalms, we pointed out that evildoers flourish. That's why they do the evil. That's the point. Nobody's doing evil and saying, oh, I want to make myself suffer. I'm going to do something bad. You do things that are bad because it's self-serving. You think you can get something out of it. So all evildoers flourish. This is how it says it. Now, he's not making a philosophical statement. I mean, the psalmist is simply saying, we recognize, we see it. I mean, evildoers flourish. The wicked, they sprout like grass and blossom up. And we see that it happens a lot. It doesn't matter that it happens all the time. What they don't get, the stupid can't see it, the fool can't understand it. What they don't get is that the wicked who sprout like grass and the evildoers who flourish, they're also doomed to destruction forever. I mean, the far extreme of it. They think they're planting themselves in such a solid way, and yet this earth is just constantly declaring to them in its open mouth of the grave that they are doomed to destruction, just like everyone else who's ever been in the world. And so I'm going to skip verse 8 for the moment and read verse 9. Again, verse 7 and verse 9 are the longest verses in the psalm. Verse 7, this is what the stupid don't understand. Verse 7, that though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. Skipping to verse 9, for behold, your enemies, O Lord, for behold, your enemies shall perish. All evildoers shall be scattered. The contrast between the miserable, short, the brief nothingness of these who opposed the mighty God, the contrast between them and that mighty God is just overwhelming. You know, his thoughts are deep and he's above everything. His works are great and cause us to be in awe at his works. And what people don't understand is that they think they're so important that they just take the place of all of that, and then they just disintegrate into the ground as if they were never there. I mean, the mountains that we celebrate in verse 4, I'm not picking out that it says mountains. The point is they are the works of his hands. The mountains that we celebrate in verse 4 or in verse 5, the seas, the oceans, the depths, the peace of the oceans, the magnitude of the prairies, everything that we celebrate, the night sky that I love, the sun by day in Psalm 19, all those things that we celebrate are so powerful, and yet they're nothing compared to God. But you compare them to the power of the person who thinks, oh, I'm going to make a name for myself. I'm going to make a place for myself in this world. And, you know, the mountain is there, and then we come, and then we go, and the mountain is still there. And so in the idea of this, you know, first stanza in the psalm, as I would take it, in the idea of this first section of the psalm, the wicked are just this transient moment that passes away into nothing compared with the magnificence of the creation, which tells us just how great the Creator is, which is why, and that's what's always being appealed to. We realize how magnificent the Creator is. It's, you know, the same as Psalm 19. I'll talk about it later on, but other passages. But this particular passage, you know, when we think about Psalm 19, the heavens declaring the glory of God, you know, and all of his creation constantly declaring that it's his handiwork. All of that tells us that the magnificence we see in the creation is pointing us toward the one who's behind the creation, the Creator. But if this world, looks at the one who's behind the creation instead of just thinking, how can I take possession of this creation? Instead of that, we look behind the creation and see the creator. What we're confronted with is judgment. What we're confronted with is that we don't endure, that we do pass away, and the truth is we deserve it. And this, in this passage, it is the stupid and the fool who do not even understand that. And part of the reason for that is not just that the wicked perish, but that, and that, I mean, that's what this psalm is focused on in verses 6 through 9. However, by the way, going back to verse 8 and inserting it here, I mean, the contrast is this tiny little statement, this brief statement that points us again to the transcendence of God by saying, but you, Yahweh, are on high forever. That height of God is what we you know, forces us to recognize his transcendence. He is above and separate from all of it. The fact that it is eternal instead of temporal makes him different than we are. It makes him transcendent. So we recognize his transcendent in the psalm in all of these ways. The fascinating thing about it is, and this is leading into the second part of the psalm that I need to read to you in just a second, the fascinating thing about it is that it would be true about us. We would need to recognize this gap between the creator and the creation, including us, whether we were perfect or not, whether we had ever fallen or not. If we were in our unfallen state, we could not lift up our hand to God and say, you owe me. We didn't have the power to even create ourselves. We still are completely his possession. I'm not pretending he would be arbitrary or capricious or cruel in his treatment to us or something like that. But I am saying, if he chose to be, who would we appeal to say that there was something wrong about what he was doing? Because even if we are completely without sin, we are still so frail, fragile, and weak in comparison with the omnipotent and omniscient God. We have nothing we can offer in comparison to him. And even in our perfect state, we could not pretend that we are bigger than the world in which we live, or that somehow we brought it to exist. Even in perfect stewardship over this world, we would only be stewards over what God had given us authority in. So you understand the point that I'm making. The contrast between this creation and the creator inherently leads us to verse 8's declaration about his transcendence. You, O Lord, are on high forever. You are different. Now verse 10 starts, and it's only 15 verses. Verse 10 begins and really takes us down a completely different road. Now, the reason is, in contrast, obviously, we're going to describe the righteous now. And so in describing the righteous, go down a different road. Of course we do. But the whole nature of the Sabbath and our recognition of it finally comes to a head here. And it goes in a completely different way. So verse 10, here's how it goes. But you have exalted my horn like that of a wild ox. You have poured over me fresh oil. And as always, when we remember to read these psalms coming from the mouth of Jesus, that he would pray this prayer, we recognize how, you know, appropriate it is. You poured over me fresh oil. This is, you have anointed me. That's the Mashiach word, the word that's, you know, we take as Messiah and Christ in the New Testament in the Greek form. This is, you know, perfect in the mouth of Jesus. And the fact that he says, you've exalted my horn like that of a wild ox, is just God has blessed me with the ability to flourish where other people are perishing. That's the blessing that he gives to people constantly in the Old Testament. I'm going to make you like a wild donkey or a wild ox, because these wild animals, they're flourishing in the middle of a desert where people would be struggling. And there's a power in that that others don't recognize. And so having just described the wicked who are constantly perishing, he says, oh, you've made me like these animals. And it you know, it helps in the continuity of the psalm because he's appealing to the creation again. So as a part of the creation, the wild ox, how does it feel? Well, God has made me like that. He's given me the ability to survive and to endure when everything else is fading away. And you'll see how that comes up in the rest of these verses down through verse 15. You've poured over me fresh oil. My eyes have seen the downfall of my enemies. My ears have heard the doom of my evil assailants. The righteous, in a section reminiscent of Psalm 1 that I'll come back to in just a moment, you'll recognize this. The righteous, they flourish like the palm tree. And they grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They're planted in the house of Yahweh, in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bear fruit in old age. They're always, ever full of sap and green to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Now, it's not just faithfulness. It's not just the height of God above the creation. It's also God being upright, that there is no unrighteousness in him. And you can hear the contrasting theme there. It's not contrasting like they're incompatible. They're not in tension with each other. They just both exist at the same time. The tension is in the recognition that one of them is primarily describing or thinking of God in that sense of his transcendence, and therefore the temporal and, you know, very brief passing nature of the current world and the wickedness that's in it. So you have that in the first part, but in the second part, this endurance of the righteous, the people who are here, and yet the end of it isn't, and so we praise the righteous people. It's not that. In having described the endurance of God's righteous people, the conclusion in the statement is to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm trying to make this one as transparent as I possibly can. We celebrate the holiness of the Creator in seeing the works of his hands and recognizing the judgment that he also brings into the world because of it. And it makes us remember just how holy he is in being set apart from the world. But we celebrate the holiness of his creation by celebrating the holiness of the Creator when he's in the world. And the holiness of the Creator in the world in this psalm is about his people being righteous in this world. So let me put it this way. If you think of that imagery that's in verse 12, the righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They're planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. It takes you directly back to Psalm 1. Psalm 1 also takes us back to the wicked who are perishing. They flourish like grass, but then they are doomed to destruction forever. That same concept and contrast is present in Psalm 1. You know, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scoffers. Why is he blessed? Because he's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf doesn't wither. The wicked are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, because Yahweh knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And, you know, in that psalm, in Psalm 1, it comes down to the Lord knowing the way of the righteous. The way of the wicked, they perish. It's just like they perish in the creation here in this psalm. But in that psalm, Psalm 1, the righteous, it's about the Lord knowing the way of the righteous. In this psalm, it's more than that. And I think understanding that also means recognizing what I think is inevitable. I mean, I would certainly take it as an illusion. I think it's an overt illusion, and I can't imagine because they're referred to so often, I can't imagine a person not sensing this or being aware of this in a psalm about the Sabbath that they're singing together in synagogues that are to replicate the presence of the temple in their land, which was itself a replication, we know, of the heavenly temple, but of the tabernacle itself, which was built with these things. And, you know, what I'm talking about is him saying, the righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon, you know, that Hiram takes down and brings down to Solomon to build the temple and to build David's house as well, by the way. That the statement in verse 13 is so important in a psalm that they're singing together on the Sabbath, that he would say about the righteous who are singing the song, that he would say about the righteous, you are like the cedars of Lebanon that have been transplanted. That's what the word planted means. Not cut down and put up, but planted in it. You've been transplanted in the house of Yahweh. Here they are gathering in the house of Yahweh and singing this song together a song that begins with the words, "It is good to give thanks to the Lord and to sing praises to your name, O Most High." The pillars in this house of God that's being described in the psalm are those who are singing about the pillars who are in the house of God. This is like a declaration from God saying, do you have any idea how important you are in my creation when you gather and worship, when you meet together to sing psalms about me? The way we conceive of it, I think, misses this point a lot. And I think the way we think about ourselves misses this point a lot. To make the point, let me give a silly but genuine experience that I had just this last 2 weekends ago as I'm recording this, where I went to this country house that my in-laws have and was trying to help take care of some things and went inside the house and was doing a few things in the house, look out the window, and there's a squirrel sitting on the rail. Well, that's not a big surprise. They're sort of out in the country. And so it's like, oh, okay, well, there's a squirrel. Look at that. And then I look out the other window. Oh, look, there's another squirrel. Oh, look, there's a couple of squirrels. And I'm seeing squirrels every time I look out the window. And finally, I realized when I raised the shade in one window, that a bunch of squirrels scattered out onto the lawn. And it's like, man, that's a lot of squirrels. I'm not used to seeing that many. I can't believe how many there are. I finally walk out onto the front porch and I look over toward the corner of the house and I can see that, I don't know, a raccoon or a grizzly bear, just a joke, a raccoon, something, has opened the tin can of birdseed. And it is, it's dumped on its side and there's seed scattered all over the place. And I'm assuming, like I told some other people the other day, I'm assuming there are squirrels sitting around all over the yard, unbuckling their belt, leaning back. Oh, man, I've had too much to eat. They just, they're stuffing themselves silly with this stuff, and they don't have any reason to stop because they've got all they want. Okay, so anyway, the seed is all over the front porch, so I'm going to have to clean it up, so I go get a blower to start. And I mean, the second I turn on the blower from a distance, I'm just getting ready to get over there to get to it, all the husks just immediately blow away. And I get that impression that we have, we're not exactly farmers. We're not sifting wheat from chaff, so we don't always get the imagery. But in this, you couldn't miss that same imagery with these husks from the seeds and things just immediately blowing away off the porch. I mean, they were gone as soon as the slightest puff of wind came along. And that's where we are in this psalm. That's where we actually are when we're the wicked. We sprout like grass, but then perish in destruction forever. We just blow away. In the first psalm, that's where we are, like the chaff that the wind drives away. It's that same imagery, and that's how we think of our lives. And very often, even though we're struggling to do something else with our lives and give ourselves some significance, the reality is we can't find it. Because we're trying to make ourselves into something we can't be. You cannot be bigger than the world you're in. You will be consumed by the world. We can't make ourselves into something that is of enduring value. It wouldn't be possible in us. And so we see ourselves as this husk of a life. And man, from youth to old age, I have seen one person after another have this comeuppance, come to this realization and grow depressed or, disheartened by the reality of who we are in the world. I've seen that. And then I read a psalm like this, and it is God's declaration that that's not where you have to be, because he makes us like the cedars of Lebanon. And in something so simple that we take so for granted. So putting it back in the context of the psalm, I just want to try to make it as clear as I can. In this psalm, in verses 4 and 5, when we're celebrating the works of his hands, we're being reminded of the lordship that he has over the creation, the grandeur, the magnitude of the creation, the intricacy of the detail and beauty that he's put into the creation. All of that reminds us of his lordship over the creation. And again, the way that manifests itself over time in what we see from what we are and what we should have been is, it finally becomes judgment. But in our initial reaction to it, it is grandeur. Look at this. we celebrate the holiness of God. And so we gather and sing songs about him being the creator, and we always will. But towards the end of the psalm, when you get to verses, especially when you get to verses 12 through 14, the righteous flourishing like the palm tree, that section where they're planted in the house of the Lord and they flourish in the courts of our God. See, we're in the psalm about the Sabbath, talking about the courts of our God. All of those statements come down to verse 15, where the statement that the believer, that God's people are making, that the believer is making, is to declare that the Lord not just is high, like in verse 8, but you, O Lord, are on high forever, but the Lord is upright. That's here. That's the pillar in the temple. He's the one who's upright, and he is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. And where is the declaration that there's no unrighteousness in him being made? It's being made in us. So as I was talking about Psalm 1 earlier, I was telling you it has that statement in it, the Lord knows the way of the righteous. But here in Psalm 92, the Lord doesn't just know the way of the righteous. He is present in the way of the righteous. He's upright, and he's making us the pillars who are in the temple. It's the same idea that's conveyed in Psalm 14 and 53. Those are the ones where it says, the fool has said in his heart, there's no God. I've talked about this 100 times in different episodes. That's hyperbole. It's not literally 100 times, but a lot of times. So I won't dwell on it. But if you remember what I'm talking about, you know, man is trying to say there's no God, but the response from God in both of those psalms is to say, that's not the problem. The problem isn't that there's no God. The problem is there's no good in you. I'm looking for someone who's righteous, and there's not anyone righteous. The lack of God's presence in the world isn't about God not being present in the world. It's about his righteous people not being present in the world. That's always what it comes down to. It's the same in Luke 17 and 18. When you take the last half of Luke 17 and put it together with the story of the unjust judge and the widow in Luke 18, again, I've talked about this before in previous episodes. You can go back and listen to those another time to get the details. But in that, it's exactly the same thing. What the skeptics say to Jesus is, when is God ever going to make things right in this world? Is the kingdom of God going to come at this time? That's how they say it. And his answer is, well, that's not the problem. The Lord's going to come back. He's always been going to come back. The question is, when he comes, is he going to find anyone faithful here? That testimony, that statement is on the negative side of saying God's righteous presence in the world is in his people. That's where his righteousness is present in the world. And it's not an accident. Now, that on the negative side, that says, so when people think God's not present, we've got no one to blame but ourselves. We're the ones who are failing. That's all on the negative side. This psalm is all on the good side. It's all on the positive side. And I want to share it with you the way the psalm is saying it. The world without God's holy people is just an empty shell. It's those husks that are just blown away. The wind blows and they just go away. And I mean the whole of creation, the magnitude of the mountains, the brilliance of the dark sky, everything that God has given in creation is nothing but an empty husk until it is filled with God's people who are holy, set apart for him, and living for him. And it's simpler than that in this psalm. The testimony of that in this psalm is not that everyone's doing everything that God ever commanded, although the commands are important, and in particular, recognizing that being his holy people means doing what he says to do to be holy. Love your neighbor as yourself, love the stranger as one who's born among you, and so on. Those statements and the so on is just that in other versions. It's the same thing. All of those aside, this psalm makes it simpler than that. Where do you find the beauty, the meat, the real content of this otherwise empty world so that it matters, so that it means something? In his people simply lifting up their voice and singing praises to his name, acknowledging that he is our God. So in verse 15, that statement to declare that the Lord is upright, he's my rock, and there's no unrighteousness in him, it points you back to the first couple of verses in the psalm, the opening to the psalm, to say it is good to give thanks to Yahweh. It's not just good because it makes you feel better. It's not just good because it makes you righteous. It's good because that's what gives, those are the pillars of God's temple. Without God's people lifting up their voices together, without God's people being together holy and set apart to him and demonstrating that on a Sabbath day, just coming together and having a worship service. And you see why I'm saying this translates so well to what we do on Sunday. You just gather together and you lift up your voices with the other believers. That feeble voice you have makes you a cedar of Lebanon transplanted into the house of Yahweh, which is, this world is the house he's built for us to inhabit. We are the pillars of this world. So he says in the first two verses of the psalm, it's good to give thanks to Yahweh, to sing praises to your name, O Most High, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night. When we do things as simple as thanking God and acknowledging him, we become what God uses to fill the world with his presence. It's a Sabbath psalm to say to those who will just pause long enough to remember that he is our God, that you are not an empty husk, that you are not the empty shell, something that needs to find purpose and meaning, that you are the kernel of his creation, that you are the pillar that he puts in his temple. You are what gives beauty and meaning to what would otherwise be the empty husk of his creation. May we live in that truth.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.